United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Coral W. Peach presiding. All of our business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning, I'm Judge Peach. On my right is Judge Bartley, and on my left is Judge Greenberg. We're here today for the matter of Tolliver v. Wilkie, number 16-3465. The issue before the court is whether the appellant is entitled to receive dependency and indemnity benefits, which is contingent upon whether the appellant's husband's death was service-connected. Would counsel for both parties please state your name and your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. April Donahower of the law firm of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick for Mrs. Tolliver. With me at counsel table is Bradley Hennings, also of the firm.
Thank you.
Norman Morris for the secretary, and with me is Sarah Casino.
Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes,
and each party will have 30 minutes to present their arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve any portion of your time?
Yes, Your Honor, 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay, thank you. You may proceed.
Judge Peach, Your Honors, and may it please the court. A shell fragment wound lodged near Mr. Tolliver's diaphragm during combat. During his lifetime, he was short of breath for reasons related to his diaphragm. His death certificate lists the shell fragment wound as a significant condition that contributed to his death. The board erred in denying service connection for Mr. Tolliver's cause of death for three reasons. First, as the Secretary concedes on page 7 of his supplemental brief, the M21 rule directs the grant of DIC under certain circumstances, which are presented here. Second, even if that provision was not binding on the board failed to explain why the other evidence was inconsistent with the death certificate. And third, the board failed to consider the reasonably raised issues of aggravation of a cause of death by the service-connected condition and whether 3.312C applied. Regardless of its placement in the M21, the provision here was a substantive rule that was binding on the board.
Now, counsel, I hate to interrupt, but in your reply brief, you withdrew the argument that the rule was binding. Can you just speak to that for a minute?
Of course, Your Honor. We did withdraw that argument in light of the fact that DAV had recently been decided. However, we understood the court's supplemental briefing order to revive the question of whether the specific provision here was binding, notwithstanding the Federal Circuit's decision in DAV. So while we continue to stand by the statement in the reply brief that DAV, of course, held that the manual in general is not binding, we, based on the supplemental pleading order, distinguish the specific provision that's at issue here.
Uh-huh. And to my recollection, in the reply brief, the only item with regard to the fast letter slash manual provision that you argued was that the board is obligated to ensure that the lower level adjudicators, even assuming that the letter is not binding on the board, which you did concede that it was not binding, that the only issue related to that was that the board had the obligation to, as I said, ensure that the lower level adjudicators applied the rule.
Yes, Your Honor, and not only that, but we did continue to argue that the board did not explain its statement that the other medical evidence of record was either inconsistent with or contradictory.
Right, you retained that and the aggravation issue.
Yes.
But I just want to be clear on what you withdrew and what you retained as far as the we'll just call it the manual provision, as far as the manual provision goes.
Yes.
Okay. So could you speak to that argument that you did retain as far as the manual that the board had although it wasn't binding on the board to apply it itself, it had some obligation to ensure that the lower level of VA did so?
Yes, and that was the issue that was presented in Patton, where what the RO did at the time had been correct, but the intervening provision rendered what the RO did incorrect. And the court said in Patton that for that provision to have any meaning, the claimant needed to have some recourse to the board, and that was why the board erred in that case in failing to take notice of the favorable provision.
So your argument is based on Patton. Any other case law? The argument about, hey, it might not be binding on the board, but the board has to ensure something happens down below.
Not only Patton, but also Morton and Relaford, which we had cited in the opening brief and which our reliance on which did not change, notwithstanding DAV, that. And both of those cases held that the agency has to follow its own procedures when adjudicating a claimant's entitlement to a benefit. And in Relaford in particular, it was a FAST letter that the board erred in failing to follow.
The board erred in failing to follow?
Yes.
But that's not the... That wouldn't support the argument that you're making here, or that I should say that you made in your reply brief.
It does insofar as the provision here originated in a FAST letter, and the Federal Circuit and DAV specifically left room for a provision like that to be binding, notwithstanding its later placement in the manual. It cited to the Military Order of the Purple Heart case, where a rule found in a FAST letter was found to be a substantive rule, and also the Coalition for Common Sense case, where the Dear Manufacturer letter was found to be a substantive rule.
Okay, so assuming that the manual provision was not binding on the board, but that, as you argued, the board had some responsibility as to the manual provision, What should the board have said?
The board was under its statutory reasons and bases obligation to, at minimum, explain its statement that the other medical evidence of record was not consistent with the death certificate. A doctor stated on the death certificate that a shell fragment wound was a contributing cause of Mr. Tolliver's death. The board, in its recitation of the evidence, acknowledged problems breathing due to the diaphragm, which was the area where the shell fragment wound was lodged. It did not actually discuss that evidence when, on page 14 of its decision, it said there's no other evidence to support the statement in the death certificate that the shell fragment wound played a role in the death. It simply relied on the VA medical opinion, which, as we argued in our briefing, was inadequate because that doctor also did not consider the medical evidence that created a link between the shell fragment lodged near the diaphragm and the shortness of breath and the fact that Mr. Tolliver died of a respiratory condition. So to answer Your Honor's question, having mentioned the death certificate, the board the board says even if the presumption were binding, the presumption was rebutted. As we argued in response to the court's question in the supplemental pleading, the presumption as worded did not allow for rebuttal. But even if the court were to disagree with that, there's no explanation from the board as to how it was rebutted. It cites a Seventh Circuit case about presumptions not carrying any evidentiary weight, and then it says there's no other evidence to support the contention in the death certificate, but it doesn't actually cite to any evidence that's contrary to the death certificate other than the inadequate medical opinion. We would argue that that same evidence that the board recited and then did not discuss in determining that the death certificate did not carry the burden to establish service connection did reasonably raise two other theories of service connection for Mr. Tolliver's cause of death, one being aggravation and the other being 3.312C, insofar as it rendered him materially less capable of resisting the effects of the conditions that were the principal causes of his death. I would direct the court's attention to page 908 of the record, where Mr. Tolliver's physician, who demonstrated familiarity with his medical history, said that he was easily short of breath due to the diaphragm. He knew about the piece of shrapnel lodged near the diaphragm. The board recited that in its listing of the evidence, but it did not discuss it. The secretary also noted that piece of evidence, but does not discuss it in arguing that that theory was not reasonably raised.
This is the aggravation theory.
Yes.
And just to clarify, what you're calling an aggravation theory, is it really a claim for secondary service connection based on aggravation? You're arguing that a claim for secondary service connection based on aggravation was raised because the service-connected chest injury aggravated what? The COPD? The chronic obstructive lung disease? The chronic respiratory failure? All three?
Correct. He died of chronic obstructive lung disease and chronic respiratory failure. And our argument is akin to the reasoning in El Amin, where the relationship between the service-connected condition and the principal cause of death created a causal chain between the service-connected condition and the cause of death. We're arguing that that was at least reasonably raised by the evidence of the effects of the shell fragment on Mr. Tolliver's ability to breathe, and the board did not discuss it at all.
And so what do we usually need to raise the issue of secondary service connection?
Well, El Amin suggests that the board it's incumbent on the board to discuss it, that under 3.310, secondary service connection is comprised of causation or aggravation, so the board should have discussed aggravation here. In terms of what is required to reasonably raise it, it's something less than as likely as not, of course, and there was evidence in the record here that directly tied his service-connected disability to his ability to breathe.
Didn't Mrs. Tolliver request that those service-connected disabilities be reflected on service-connected disabilities be reflected on the death certificate?
She did testify to that, Your Honor. The board did not mention that in any way as a reason for disregarding the death certificate, and the death certificate was ultimately completed by a medical professional whose professional license was on the line. And
you mean a doctor?
Correct, Your Honor. A doctor completed the death certificate.
So why should anybody look behind what a doctor put on a death certificate in this context?
No one should, Your Honor.
Shouldn't that be the end of the case? It's on the death certificate.
Yes, Your Honor. It's
VA employees are directed by M21 or policy or custom or usage, training.
Correct, Your Honor. And the FAST letter goes into some explanation as to why that is, and so this court can see that this provision is analogous to prior instances where the secretary has determined to provide a claimant with some assistance in meeting his or her burden to establish entitlement to a benefit.
You raise a good point. Would you argue, not that you have to, but is it arguable that under the statutory duty to assist, perhaps the secretary has the obligation to deal with a veteran's death certificate and what should be contained on a death certificate, assuming it's medically correct, what should be included there?
If I understand Your Honor correctly,
here's the situation. Most veterans, when they die or are on the point of death, don't have lawyers ready to bring cases. They have relatives, they have family, they have people who are not knowledgeable about the FAST letter concept, the M21, the regulations, the statutes. So what about the obligation of the secretary, rather than broadly speaking, in every individual case under the duty to assist, to say, look, Mrs. Tolliver, better make sure that death certificate, in this case, in these circumstances, contains, if it's correct, medically correct to do so, contains a relationship between the service-connected injury and the cause of death?
I think that's exactly what the FAST letter did, Your Honor. It recognized a policy to prioritize efficient grant of benefits under these circumstances over further developing the record. So it provided a pretty extensive explanation.
So would it be possible for us to conclude that nothing more was needed except death certificate containing a connection between a service-connected condition and the cause of death?
I think it would be,
Isn't
Your Honor.
Isn't that sufficient for us to rule in favor of the veteran or the appellant in this case?
Yes, I believe it would be, Your Honor. The Secretary was free to create that relaxation, so to speak, of the evidentiary requirement under 501A and did so much in the same way that the Secretary has created presumptions elsewhere, and having done so has pronounced that the death certificate is enough to establish that it's at least as likely as not that the service-connected condition was a principal or contributory cause of the death.
What Mr. Tolliver was also service-connected for a hearing loss. What if that hearing loss was listed as well as contributory? I mean, is there a connection that hearing loss would affect would he died of CPOD or does that make any sense?
I would note, Your Honor, that the court needn't reach that here because the doctor did not list hearing loss on the death certificate. She listed PTSD and the two shell fragment wound injuries. So there's no need to reach the question of whether a patently implausible condition listed on the death certificate was contributory.
But what if that had been the case, if she said something to the doctor, can you list all of his service-connected disabilities on it? Well, what are they, hearing loss, muscle, PTSD? I mean, for the sake of discussion, what if it were listed on the death certificate?
For the sake of discussion, the court isn't compelled to look at something patently implausible and say that it is. But I would reiterate here that we have a doctor whose license was at issue, a medical professional who did not list every single service-connected disability. She listed a selective.
So we need not deal with that issue here.
Correct, Your Honor.
And even if all of the service-connected conditions have been listed on the death certificate, it's beside the point, isn't it, as long as one of them is connected to the cause of death?
Correct.
But how would you know which one it is?
The FAST letter has stated the Secretary's view that if the condition is listed on the death certificate, that is sufficient. And we have a doctor saying...
And you don't have tinnitus here.
Correct. Or he also, I believe, had a ruptured eardrum, which was also not listed on the certificate.
Well, even though you... withdrew your argument about the FAST letter, or the manual provisions, I should say, I will jump right in here since they seem to be a point of discussion. Weren't there already two negative medical opinions of record when the FAST letter issued, and or at least one? And what impact would that have on this case with regard to the FAST letter manual provision?
There were two medical opinions of record prior to March 2013 when the FAST letter was promulgated, although the second one was with regard to PTSD only. So there was only one with regard to the shell fragment wound.
Excuse me, let's add 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. At that point, with the promulgation of the FAST letter, no further development was needed, and yet an additional medical opinion was obtained in May 2013. That is the one that we argued is inadequate in our brief. I believe that with the issuance of the FAST letter, the Secretary or VA needn't have conducted any further evidentiary development, and at that point there was sufficient evidence to grant the claim at that point, and the Secretary's discretion to develop the record ended at the point when it was clear, pursuant to the FAST letter, that the record was sufficient to decide the claim.
But at that point, there was the opinion from Dr. Bellinger?
Correct.
Already of record saying, no, the chest muscle impairment did not cause or contribute to the death.
Right, and to that point, Your Honor, I would say again that even if that the prior opinion of record, the board certainly on appeal wasn't necessarily obligated to ignore that. If the court disagrees that the FAST letter was binding, but there's no explanation in the board's decision as to how the evidence overcame what the death certificate stated. Have I not answered Your Honor's question?
Well, I mean, it seems... I don't know how much to go into this because, really, you withdrew the argument.
Yes. Understood.
But it's unusual in that the manual provision does say to grant service connection. However, we had a perfectly validly developed negative medical opinion here. Would you argue that VA should, in such cases, simply ignore negative medical evidence? Or what should it do with validly developed medical evidence in these instances?
Let's assume you agree that it was validly developed.
Which we, as we argued, it was not, because Dr. Bellinger did not consider certain evidence in Mr. Tolliver's medical history.
Well, that would be valid development, wouldn't it? But it would just be incomplete or somewhat inadequate, perhaps.
Correct, Your Honor. And if I understand the court to be saying that we need to look elsewhere other than whether the FAST letter was binding here, we simply do not have an explanation from the board that says why the medical evidence made it not at least as likely as not that Mr. Tolliver's death was service connected, because it overlooked treatment records suggesting that there was some relationship, and it relied exclusively on a medical opinion that was inadequate.
Well, wouldn't Dr. Let me just get the. Let me get the 2013 medical opinion. So, in the 2013 medical opinion, the doctor said COPD. This is whenever this is also Dr. Bellinger. Dr. Bellinger was talking about whether the shell fragment wound and retained foreign body in the chest muscle group caused or contributed to his death. Okay, so the doctor admits the veteran had a significant chest wound, significantly penetrating chest wound, near the esophageal diaphragmatic junction. The veteran, he says, recovered from that, then says COPD is a disease of small airways, and chronic pulmonary failure is a disease of inadequate oxygenation of the blood. And suggests, perhaps not as explicitly as one might like, that this is a different kind of disability that would not be impacted by a retained foreign body near the diaphragm. Do you get that from this medical opinion?
Let's add 5 more minutes.
I do not, and I would also point out that the statement that the veteran's history after the military was one of recovery and achievement fails to take into account the medical records that we cited to, the being easily short of breath due to the diaphragm, both several years after service and beginning at least several years before this opinion. So for a doctor to pronounce that the history was one of recovery and achievement after having acknowledged the significant penetration chest wound and without discussing any of the medical evidence regarding being easily short of breath due to the diaphragm is one problem. And the other problem is he doesn't explicitly say, as Your Honor said, even if we can fairly infer, I believe it's making inference upon inference to say that he was saying that there could not be any kind of relationship between the shortness of breath due to the diaphragm and the disease of the small airways. They may be impacting the respiratory system in two different ways, but I'm not a doctor, I and neither was the board, presumably, and there's just no way to know from this opinion what, if any, relationship there was between the two. there are no further questions, we would respectfully ask the court to remand for the board to comply with the provision.
I do have one or two more questions here. Talk to me a little bit about your Bryant-type argument, especially, I think it was in your reply brief at 11.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what you mentioned the word countering there, and I want to make sure I get your argument about maybe you didn't mean to use that word. but tell me a little bit about what you're arguing there.
We would argue that it's a close case with regard to the hearing officer's advising of Mrs. Tolliver. Perhaps, as Your Honor suggests, that that word choice was not exactly precise. But we do think, as argued in the pleadings, that there was not really evidence of record dealing with the aggravation issue, I think is the point of the Bryant argument there, and that Mrs. Tolliver was not really made aware that that was a potential avenue.
Oh, okay. So that hinges on your argument that secondary service connection for worsening of the chronic respiratory failure and chronic obstructive lung disease was raised and should have been developed.
And in conjunction with that, she testified at least one point during the hearing that she had observed her husband being short of breath for as long as she had known him.
Uh-huh. Okay. I took that argument to mean that the board hearing officer advised the appellant to get affirmative evidence that would support that the service-connected conditions caused death, but did not advise her to get a medical opinion directly countering the negative opinions that were of record.
I see my time has...
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's add a couple more minutes. Let's add three more minutes.
I understand Your Honor's reading of that. I believe the first characterization is more accurate.
Got it. All right.
Just to make it clear, you're saying that the hearing officer should have advised Mrs. Tolliver about evidence regarding the aggravation aspect?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay. No other questions? You may continue.
We would therefore ask the court, as argued in the supplemental pleadings, and in our principal pleadings, to remand for the board to either comply with the FAST letter provision or, in the alternative, to give adequate reasons and bases for why the medical evidence was inconsistent.
So you're not arguing for us to merely reverse for failure to comply with the guidance from the secretary to their employees, that if it's on the death certificate, that's the end of the argument? You're abandoning that?
We are not abandoning that, Your Honor. We're if the court is understood to have revived the question as to whether the M21 provision is binding, then as argued in the supplemental pleadings, we would ask the court to reverse the board's denial as inconsistent with the M21
provision. And enter judgment in favor of the appellant.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And in the alternative, to remand for the board to give adequate reasons and bases. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Your Honors, I had intended specifically to respond in further part to the court's supplemental briefing order, and although I'm not entirely sure at this point what the true issues are, while we do believe that the appellant had abandoned the argument with respect to the binding effects of the manual, it was also my belief that the court had sua sponte resurrected that argument as an argument that it did want to hear. In that regard, Your Honors, we do believe that the Federal Circuit decisions in DAV and Gray did make clear that M21 provisions are not substantive rules, are not binding on the agency or the board, and do not create any rights on the
board. If I may, suppose we accept that for the moment. How is it that the Secretary trains his or her subordinates who are making these decisions at the regional office in how to make them?
It is primarily through the manual, Your Honor.
The M21 manual?
That is correct. That is one of the number of resources.
What kind of person in this case, in the Tolliver case, made the initial decision? A doctor? A clerk?
A first-line adjudicator.
A what?
A first-line adjudicator.
What's that?
It is the adjudicator who sees a case in the first instance.
Well, what is the training and experience of the adjudicator in this case? What kind of training does this first-line adjudicator get in this case?
I couldn't tell you what that adjudicator, the training that the adjudicator got in
this case. Well, you can tell me what the Secretary requires as basic training for people making decisions about veterans, can't you?
No, I cannot tell you in the absolute terms.
Why can't you? Isn't it a matter of record that you need to go to certain classes, get certain training, read certain documents like the M21 or fast letters or whatever?
Your Honor,
I'm interested in the notion here of there's got to be some relationship between those who are making these decisions and the training they receive.
That is correct.
And the education they receive.
That is correct.
Pursuant to the Secretary's power under the statute to adopt regulations and make these decisions.
Your Honor, the Secretary obviously strives for decisions to be correct, under the law.
So
the Secretary has...
Sorry to interrupt. So apart from the notion of whether the M21 is binding, whether it creates an irrebuttable presumption, apart from that, what is the purpose of the M21?
The purpose of the M21 is to provide guidance to the VBA employees, the adjudicators. Those adjudicators, Your Honor, the VA system is two-tiered. At the top is the Board of Veterans Appeals, veterans law judges, and attorneys. At the bottom tier, the first-line adjudicators, they're not attorneys. They're not expected to necessarily be able to interpret the law the same way that the upper tier is. Therefore, there are things such as the manual, which take the law and they try to simplify it. And they do this for several reasons, and part of it is to ensure to encourage efficiency in the adjudicative process.
And consistency.
And consistency, not inconsistency.
I said and consistency.
Consistency, yes.
Efficiency and consistency.
Efficiency and consistency are the two primary goals of providing a training manual or any type of guideline manual to employees. That's correct. But again, it makes sense given that these are first-line adjudicators, and it would be unduly burdensome to require those adjudicators to engage in legal analysis that they are potentially not trained for, so this is a simplified way.
Well, what's the legal analysis here? Didn't they get this direction saying if it's on the death certificate, that's the end of the discussion?
I apologize. I was responding to the question as to why there is a manual, and I believe that is partially why there is a manual, because it's to simplify and expedite the process by simplifying certain aspects of adjudication. It does not make that manual binding, though. Whether that manual has a binding effect on the agency is a question that has been resolved by the Federal Circuit, and that the answer to that is that it is not. So while this is a series of, these are guidelines that a VBA employee is provided with, much the same as any other training that a VBA employee may receive, be it orally through a training seminar or initially at orientation, these are guidelines. These are a part of the agency's attempt to expedite and make more efficient the adjudicative process. We were talking about millions of claims and many, many VBA employees. And again, these VBA employees are not necessarily lawyers or expected to function as lawyers at that level. So this is a process that simply brings...
Did the VBA employee, this first-line adjudicator, do you know whether they had knowledge of this policy concept, whether it's embodied in the M21 or elsewhere, that when the death certificate links a condition to a service-connected condition, that's the end of the discussion as far as granting the benefit?
There is no reason to believe that the VBA employee did not have access to all of the tools and resources made available to VBA employees up to and including this manual provision and or the FAST letters, the prior FAST letters, which were since rescinded. So there's nothing to suggest that they weren't. But the ultimate question, and the ultimate question as the Federal Circuit recognizes, is whether the adjudication was proper under the law. The board is not constrained in any way by whether the VBA employee complied or did not comply with the provision of the internal guidance manual, the M21. The question is whether the board's analysis and adjudication was appropriate, because the board, too, is neither bound by that manual provision nor required to ensure that any of the provisions of that manual were correctly applied. So, again, it's simply just an internal guidance mechanism that, yes, a VBA employee must follow, but that does not create any right to enforcement of that provision by a third-party claimant. It is an internal manual. And to that end, did I answer your question?
Oh, yeah. I understand it completely. You're standing on that? The Secretary publishes these materials for his subordinates to follow, but they don't have to follow it?
I'm suggesting that the have to follow is with respect to the relationship between the VBA employee and the VBA as the employer. These are expectations and these are guidelines that a VBA employee has to follow because it is created by the employer. But it does not mean that it creates a right to enforcement of compliance, you know, by a third-party claimant.
Well, what's the point of having it if you can't enforce it? Is this merely precatory? Is that what you're saying? Everything in the M21 or the classes these people take, if they take any, or the training they get, is just a suggestion?
It is a guideline. A guideline may be interpreted as a suggestion, but it would be a very strong suggestion because there is a very real possibility that a VBA employee who continuously disregards training of any sort, again, whether it's in the manual or whether it's in a seminar or whether it's the supervisor walks into the room and says, you should do things like X, Y, Z. Again, that is simply just a matter of that employee's conduct within the agency, and the agency has every right to expect certain things from its employees, and one of them may be to read the manual and to, you know, adhere to those provisions. But again, it does not create a substantive right, and it is not simply me that is standing here suggesting that. That is specifically what the Federal Circuit found when it reviewed the M21 provisions at issue in DAV and Gray. It specifically found that these did not create substantive rules, and that the provisions of the M21 are not binding on the agency and the board. So again, while a VBA employee may be required to follow it, it is very distinct from whether following that to the T or not following it creates a cause of action by a claimant. It does not, because
what about this decision of the I don't know what court is it? Patton v. West. Do you familiar with that case?
I believe that was this court.
Well, we held that the board cannot disregard portions of the M21-1 that are favorable to a veteran when adjudicating that veteran's claim. Has that been overturned by the Federal Circuit?
Yes, to the extent that the Federal Circuit in DAV and Gray found that the M21 does not create substantive rules, that it is not binding on the agency or the board. It explicitly overrules this court's decision in Patton to the extent that Patton is deemed to require the board to adhere to or otherwise ensure compliance with the provisions of the M21 that are favorable to a claimant. So yes, Your Honor, it does overrule Patton.
Thank you.
And so the Secretary believes that, well, DAV spoke in very broad language, but I'm trying to remember whether the whether the Taranto concurrence was in DAV or Gray.
Gray.
Gray. Yeah. Well, then, okay. Then I'm referring to Gray. the Secretary believes there are no exceptions from the broad holding. And because at least one of the judges obviously believed that it was that the question of whether manual provisions are binding depended on the specific manual provision at issue.
With due respect, I don't read DAV or Gray to leave open the possibility of any currently existing manual provisions being deemed substantive rules. And that is because of the three factors that the Federal Circuit laid out, you know, which are the agency's characterization of the action, whether it's published in the Federal Register or Code of Federal Regulations, and whether it has a binding effect on the agency, the third question being somewhat derivative of the first two. In all cases, the manual provisions are characterized by the Secretary to be part of internal guidelines and not substantive rules, and that's reflected in the Secretary's statement in the Federal Register. So that applies to all manual provisions. No manual provision has been published in the Federal Register or otherwise in the Code of Federal Regulations. So while it is true for all that these cases categorically exclude all current M21 provisions, it does leave open a theoretical possibility that a future manual provision could potentially meet the Federal Circuit's test for whether something is a substantive rule. Again, the Secretary could add to the Federal Register a statement explicitly stating the following provisions are, you know, considered to be substantive rules, and then publish those provisions in the Federal Register. So that would undermine, that would be different than any manual provision that currently exists. So in that sense, I believe that at least open a theoretical possibility, but it categorically excludes every current manual provision that exists. And to that end, I do believe that the whole, I apologize for this.
No, my observation is just that you would have to analyze every provision individually, I think.
Given that we do know that no provision has, that all provisions are covered by the Secretary's statement in the Federal Register, the Secretary didn't leave any ambiguity in terms of what he believed or intended the manual to be, and given that no provisions are published in the Federal Register or Code of Federal Regulations, and the statute that governs the board, you know, whether what the board is bound to specifies only regulations of the department, instructions of the secretary, and the presidential opinions of the chief legal officer. So that, the Federal Circuit recognized, is a closed list. Arguably, perhaps, if the first two factors were, the agency characterized it as a substantive rule and it was published in the Federal Register, then perhaps, arguably, there would be some room to suggest that maybe this is an instruction of the Secretary or something else where the board would be bound by it. But so long as those first two factors are not met, so long as the Secretary, via his statement in the Federal Register, expresses that all manual provisions are internal guidelines, and as long as none of those provisions have been published in the Federal Register or Code of Federal Regulations, the answer to the third question is always going to be, as the Federal Circuit recognized, the manual is not a regulation of the department, instruction of the secretary, or presidential opinion of the chief legal officer. And because of that, oh, sorry.
If the M21 is not binding, then where does that leave the Secretary with respect to its usage?
It's used for purposes of, I suppose training is a good way to put it, or for, you know, how VBA employees, again, these are first-line adjudicators, typically non-attorneys, that are dealing with millions of claims, and the idea is for them to process these claims as expeditiously as possible without taking too much time to necessarily analyze concepts that are perhaps outside of their area of expertise. So utilizing this manual, much like utilizing any other manner of training, be it orally or be it in some other form of writing, it's used to help the VBA employees expeditiously and consistently adjudicate claims.
So they're free to use it or not use it?
They may not be free to ignore it in terms of their relationship with their employer. But again, there's a distinction between the relationship between a VBA employer, employee and VBA as the employer, saying that you have to do X, Y, Z, no different than if the VBA employer created a dress code and the employee decided, you know, to go against that dress code or time requirements. Those are matters that exist between the employee and the employee and the employer, but it does not give rise to a cause of action by a third party, by a claimant against the agency. And that is precisely what, you know, what the appellant is suggesting in terms of a right to enforcement of the application of those manual provisions.
So if the board did not, or if the secretary chose not to use a particular provision, and in this case this one, would it be unreasonable to have an explanation of why they didn't use it, or maybe why they did use it?
No. Potentially a supervisor could ask a VBA employee that very question, but it is not a matter to which a claimant has any right. And again, that claim, once it's adjudicated by the first-line adjudicator, does get appealed to the Board of Veterans' Appeals. That board is not bound by those provisions, and as Gray made clear, it is also not bound to accept any prior adjudication based on compliance with those provisions. So the board has no obligation to either apply those provisions itself or to ensure that they were applied in any particular way in the first instance by the RO adjudicators. The question before the board is whether the law, which the board is bound by, again, the regulations, the instructions of the secretary, and the precedential opinions of the general counsel, whether those, as applied to the facts of the case, were done correctly and consistent with the statutory burdens and so forth. So I don't believe there's any inherent contradiction in saying that a VBA employee is required to follow these provisions, while at the same time the board is not required to apply them, or that a claimant is not entitled to seek, you know, seek relief because of a failure or to apply them or to even to correctly apply them. And ultimately, because of all that, to address some of the earlier questions that were asked of appellant's counsel, no, the M21 provisions cannot create any form of strict rule or even true evidentiary presumption, and no, they cannot constrain the secretary's discretion or authority to develop evidence in DIC claims, because again, they are non-enforceable provisions by a third party, so they cannot create any actual rules to which an appellant or a claimant may seek relief. To the extent that Your Honors had inquired about, you know, the evidence and so forth, the only parameter to the Secretary's development of evidence in this case are those parameters that this Court has recognized, which is he intentionally seeking negative evidence, or, you know, with the purpose of seeking to deny a claim or overcome favorable evidence.
The Secretary believes that's the case even with, I mean, as I pointed out to appellant's attorney, there's already negative evidence of record here when the FAST letter and subsequently the manual provision issued. But that statement that you just made about absolutely no curtailment of evidence development in these DIC cases where service-connected conditions are listed, that is the Secretary's position even with regard to deaths, DIC applications after this provision was incorporated into the manual in 2015?
Yes, Your Honor, because again, I mean, the FAST letter was rescinded. To the extent that portions of it or a summary version of certain aspects of it were incorporated into the manual, the Secretary had a choice. The Secretary could have sought to promulgate certain aspects as a regulation, in which case it would have had the binding effect of law. Instead, the Secretary chose to put certain aspects of that into a manual, which the Secretary recognized earlier had specified was simply for purposes of internal guidance. So no, I don't believe that there were any constraints on it. That the Secretary was fully permitted to develop the evidence, and that is, and again, when reviewed by the Board, again, the regulation itself makes clear, the governing regulation makes clear that it is the totality of the evidence that has to be considered, that sound judgment has to be used. Sound judgment cannot be used looking at the face of this death certificate. In fact, the regulation even notes of specific importance an autopsy report. Obviously, an autopsy report is very different than a death certificate. And I would also even suggest that on the face of this particular death certificate, it wouldn't be sufficient. The appellant was, suggesting or is seeking service connection for cause of death based on a contributory cause, and this death certificate specifically indicates that those listed conditions did not actually cause death. The regulation also requires that causal connection. So on the face of this death certificate, even if this was the only piece of evidence that existed, it still would not have been sufficient. And to assume that the manual provisions would have required the grant is incorrect, because again, those manual provisions have no binding force on any party. So they're ultimately irrelevant to the proper adjudication of the claim. I would note too, just in terms of this particular death certificate, that the death certificates are generated typically by counties. This one, in fact, indicates that it was signed off on by a physician, but specifically not an examiner, not anybody who actually even examined the veteran. And as the record in this case shows, the veteran, or the appellant, was the one who directed this physician to include these things on the death certificate, suggesting that it would be wholly inappropriate to grant benefits simply on the basis of accepting a death certificate that doesn't even indicate any causation sufficient to satisfy the regulation, but also where the appellant ultimately conceded that it was because of her that these.
Yeah, but you've already argued that even if you had Dr. DeBakey or Dr. Schweitzer or you name it sign the death certificate, you're free to ignore it. Secretary and his subordinates are free to ignore it.
Your Honor, this case...
That's your argument, isn't it?
That this case is no different than any other case that comes through the veterans' claim system, be it a claim for direct, for service connection or for DIC benefits. If the evidentiary record, as it exists at the time a claim is filed, has, probative evidence in support of every element of a claim, then... In theory, that claim would be granted if it's sufficient found by the board. The board would have to otherwise rebut it, right, by a preponderance of the evidence. In this case, this document does not even, to me, which again is not really at issue here because those findings are to be made by the board and by the adjudicators, but simply looking at this death certificate, it does not appear that it would ever suffice to meet that threshold of satisfying the elements of a claim. And I would note, Your Honor, that Your Honor's own case law would suggest that it wouldn't. This is effectively no different than a checkmark box on an MEV report, which the court found was not persuasive or was not probative in Horn. So there's no rationale, there's no indication, there's no further statements, and we have a death certificate which simply lists certain causes as contributing but not actually leading to death. And so, no, Your Honor, I don't believe that this would be sufficient on its face with or without any manual provisions.
So as to the appellant's argument about secondary service connection based on aggravation being reasonably raised, talk to me a little bit about that. What's the framework for determining whether something is reasonably raised, an issue like secondary service connection? And
it is derived essentially initially from the pleadings, and when those pleadings are read in the context of the record as a whole, the determination is made as to whether it was reasonably raised. To that end, Your Honor, I believe that our response in our brief adequately addressed that insofar as there is nothing in this record that reasonably raises it. Sure, an argument can potentially always be made after the fact as to why facts might have been looked at differently, and the appellant in this case has done just that, has provided a new narrative looking at the facts, but it does not mean that the board's failure to recognize a matter as reasonably raised was wrong. simply means that evidence can always be reinterpreted, especially after the fact. And that's precisely what happened in this case, that it was not reasonably raised. There was no reason for the opinions of the board to have otherwise addressed that matter.
And so with regard to all of the notations of dyspnea that the appellant points to?
Again, Your Honor, that might have made a more or potentially persuasive argument if made to the board, connecting different pieces of evidence that, again, it's not unreasonable for the board not to have drawn those conclusions or not to have believed these, that there were these connections. The standard is still one of reasonableness, not one of mere possibility, as to whether one could possibly make an argument to connect certain dots. And I don't believe that this record reasonably raised that matter such that the board was incorrect in its adjudication. I do believe that the board's decision as a whole addressed the issues that were reasonably raised and ultimately provided a plausible decision regarding appellant's claims. If Your Honors have no further questions, again, responding to the court's original questions, we submit that Patton was explicitly overruled, that the provisions are not binding on the agency or the board, and therefore can create no rules one way or the other that constrain the secretary's constrain the secretary or otherwise give a right to a claimant. So thank you, Your Honors.
First, to respond to a couple of the points that opposing counsel made about DAV and Gray, we believe that DAV and Gray left open the possibility that a provision such as the one here could still be binding on the board. And the Federal Circuit in DAV explicitly said that the question is not resolved by the title of the document in which the provision at issue is located. Also, importantly, we are not at the same procedural posture here that the court was at in DAV. We're not talking about pre-enforcement review of a rule. We're not talking about meeting the burden to establish jurisdiction under 502. The Federal Circuit in Splain, which the Secretary cited in a supplemental pleading, in fact, the court's analysis there specifically decouples the jurisdictional analysis from the question of whether a rule is substantive or not. So it found jurisdiction with not a lot of discussion in that case and then went on to determine whether the rule was substantive or not. And we're in that latter analysis here. And furthermore, the provision here falls within a number of the counterexamples that the court gave in DAV and followed in Gray. It's not interpretive, as the provisions in both of those cases were. We're not interpreting 3.312 or 1310, excuse me. The Secretary has established a way to allow a claimant to meet his or her evidentiary burden as established by existing law, given an assist, so to speak, in the same way that a presumption established in a regulation does. So we're not talking about the meaning of a muckney, as in DAV or the blue water, brown water distinction in Gray. And there's been a lot of reliance placed on the particular Federal Register provision about the Secretary not intending the M21 as a general matter to be binding. However, the Secretary has explicitly acknowledged that particular provisions despite their placement in the M21, are substantive rules. We cited to some of those in our Rule 30B submission. So we would argue that that one blanket statement about the M21 as a general matter not being binding does not erase the significance of those other statements. And the provisions that the Secretary did concede were substantive despite their placement in the M21 were quite similar to the one here. They were in somewhere in the context of PTSD, I believe somewhere in the context of asbestos-related exposure, but they said a provision that allows, that gives a claimant an assistance in meeting the evidentiary burden is a substantive rule. So
if it's substantive, shouldn't that have gone through the rulemaking process?
Yes, Your Honor. Ordinarily, a substantive rule to be procedurally valid would have to go through that that process. However, we're dealing with a provision here that is favorable to the claimant, and there are suggestions in the case law that such a provision would continue to be binding on the agency unless and until it's rescinded in conformity with the APA. Castellano talks about that to some extent, that a favorable provision remains binding until it's properly rescinded. I believe the court in Fugger said something to the same effect. So whether it was initially adopted according to proper procedures isn't dispositive of whether it's binding on the agency. And in the meantime, the agency is not allowed to ad hoc disregard this rule so that some claimants get the benefit of that relaxed evidentiary requirement and others do not. I would just to respond to opposing counsel's point, this is not a matter that pertains to internal agency procedure quite clearly, where it directs VBA employees to grant a particular benefit when the requirements set forth there are met. And insofar as it's been portrayed as being at odds with the obligation to exercise sound judgment in looking at the evidence, that sound judgment, just like 7104, just like 5107, creates a floor. Of course, in general, the board is obligated to look at all of the evidence of record in making its decision, but what a presumption does is to narrow that universe for the claimant's benefit. The case we cited, Jensen, in the supplemental pleading, acknowledged that the Secretary, of course, is able to create those presumptions for a claimant's benefit, and the Secretary, of course, has done so in regulations.
So if they're presumptions, are they rebuttable?
They're rebuttable where there's provision made for what standard is sufficient for rebuttal. Here, however, we don't have that. It simply directs the grant of the benefit. It doesn't even say presume that the disability caused death. It simply says grant the benefit. So we're not dealing with a provision where it says absent affirmative evidence to the contrary, as do a number of the presumptions regarding herbicide exposure. It's unambiguously a direction to grant the benefit. And that same mandatory language is evidence that it is a binding rule. There have been a number of post hoc attacks on the death certificate's validity. I would say, firstly, as we discussed in the opening argument, the board did not discuss the validity of the death certificate at all. The board seemed to accept it. We certainly don't have any window on what the board thought about it. And I would add as a side point there that the fact that a claimant is testifying to asking a doctor to place certain conditions on the death certificate raises serious questions about claimant's reliance on a provision in determining what evidence to present, only to have the agency able to disregard that on an ad hoc basis after they've relied on it. And in terms of there being no rationale for the diagnosis, the listing of the causes of death, a doctor is presumed to correctly diagnose a condition, or at least, in the Cohen case, in terms of PTSD, is presumed to diagnose in accordance with the DSM. So, and yet again, we come to the fact that the board did not question the doctor's rationale for listing those conditions. Finally, as to whether aggravation or whether 3.312C was reasonably raised, the board's own decision contains at least a mention of the evidence that reasonably raised that. It was not simply raised for the first time. The board mentioned shortness of breath due to the diaphragm and simply failed to discuss that in its analysis. So, Your Honors, for those reasons, we would ask the court to direct the board to comply with the M21 provision, or in the alternative, to remand for the board to either adequately explain its departure from that provision, because it has to mean something, or to consider the reasonably raised issues of aggravation or 3.312. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.
All rise.